As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the 3-0 Show, part of the Athletic Baseball Show. Derek Van Riper, Eno Saris, Britt Jaroli, all back together. It is Friday, May 20th. As I mentioned yesterday, a little switcheroo in the order for this week. Keith Law had his first mock draft of 2022 out, so we changed the order to talk about that the day that it came out, which gave us an extra day to gather our thoughts. And what we're going to do today is focus a lot on possible breakouts, both among hitters and pitchers. We're going to talk about players still being upset with the baseball. The complaints have changed slightly compared to the past. That's why I think it's still pretty interesting to talk about it. And we're going to begin today with Max Scherzer walking off with an injury on Wednesday night. At the time of this recording, early Thursday afternoon on the East Coast. We don't know the extent of the injury yet. It's been described as a left side injury, and Scherzer has had an MRI, but maybe we'll get the results as we're rolling along. Britt, you haven't seen Max Scherzer walk off the mound very often, and usually when he does, it means something is actually wrong. Left side injury immediately makes me think it's probably something connected to the oblique, but what's the situation here, and how well prepared do you think the Mets are to be without him for maybe at least just a few turns in the rotation?
Yeah, having covered him in DC, guys, watching him say, "I'm done," means he can't pitch around or through whatever the injury was. And he's pitched around or through tons of things. This guy pitched with a fractured thumb for parts of a season, a broken nose, a black eye, a back issue, a hamstring issue. So I thought the same thing, Derek. I thought oblique. And that's not great. I mean, you're happy it's not the arm, right? Except the Mets are already missing Jacob deGrom. It looks now like July on Jacob deGrom is the best case scenario, not June. So you can't really afford to be without Max Scherzer for any length of time. And the thing with obliques is they're those pesky injuries that you can't really test, because if you test them, you could potentially re-injure it. So it takes much longer than people realize to come back from an oblique injury. I'm hopeful that maybe it's just something with his back locking up that caused that side to feel a little tight. But again, he's such a tough guy that it really, really is concerning. And no, the Mets do not have enough to cover for him and DeGrom being out. I think if DeGrom was closer to a return, yeah, you'd feel a little better about this. But if you're a Mets fan and you're perennially thinking, why us? Worst case scenario, you are really waking up this morning thinking, why us? This is the worst case scenario.
Yeah, and it's also bad news that Tyler Megill has, right biceps tendonitis and is shut down for a little bit right now. Because he was such a kind of he stepped forward and was that young player that can provide teams depth. Teams use seven starting pitchers on average in bulk, use 10 or 11 on average over the given season. The Mets are going to push that number. I bet you they'll be above it. The good news, I guess, is that David Peterson and Trevor Williams are, I would consider, major league depth pieces. They are it gets worse around the league. You know, mm-hmm. Trevor Williams is a kind of a low stuff, high command guy, but right now he's found a way to get first pitch strikes and make the most of his arsenal. David Peterson has a little bit more stuff, a little bit more wild. But he is a lefty at least, so maybe they can use him in some good matchups. And between the two of them, maybe just skate by and play 500 ball, you know, for a month, you know, while they're waiting for the two aces back. I think they've built, you know, enough wins in the schedule so far that they'll still be fine. But I do not think that they will play at the same rate that they've been playing for the next month. I mean, without both their aces, it's going to be one of those sort of like hold on tight and you know, see how many winnable games we can get and don't worry about the rest.
It's going to come down to a few different things. I think it's going to come down to Taiwan Walker pitching better than he has to this point. Carlos Carrasco sustaining his effectiveness. He's not vintage Carrasco with the high K rate, but he's not walking guys. He's keeping the ball in the park. He's pitching well enough. So if he either ticks up a little bit or at least holds what he's done, that goes a long way. And then Chris Bassett, you know, that move that they made post lockout, that was a huge addition. That's turning out to be extremely important for them.
He's the ace for the next month plus.
Yeah, temporary ace. I mean, I think it's that combination of Scherzer and DeGrom being down and then McGill on top of that, because McGill had for a little while really done a good job of looking like DeGrom as much as anyone else can look like Jacob DeGrom. I think the thing that would keep me upright if I were a Mets fan is that these are not the Wilpon Mets. These are the Steve Cohen Mets, and that probably means that they're back on the phone trying to add another starting pitcher, whether it's Frankie Montas or someone else. I mean, yeah, the pipeline from Oakland already open. They already made the deal to get Bassett, so just go to those old calls, call them back up again. Maybe you can add Frankie Montas to the equation as well. Plus, the offense is good, right? They could score runs in bunches, so it might be a stretch where they simply have to out-hit their pitching. Britt doesn't agree on the offense side necessarily.
I think Lindor needs to step up. If Scherzer's going to be hurt and DeGrom is going to be out, Lindor needs to play like a superstar, not a league average player. And after a really hot start, if you guys notice his stats lately, there's been a lot of talk in New York about should they move him down the batting order? What do they do with him? He keeps coming up in big spots and not coming through. So maybe rather than looking at this as like, how do we fix the pitching? It's like, how do we fix Francisco Lindor, who's already here, who's already get paid a lot of money, who I think is signed for 9 more years. That maybe becomes the focal point in a world without Scherzer.
Yeah, I think the last few weeks have not been kind to Lindor after what looked like a great start. And he could still have that full bounce back season where he looks like the guy we saw at the end of his time in Cleveland. What continues to surprise me, and this is the result of the offensive environment that we're in right now, Lindor is now at 231 with a 329 OBP this season and a 395 slugging percentage. That's 14% better than a league average.
14% better than league average.
What on earth? It's not. Like, it looks bad. Like, I see that line. I'm like, oh, that's brutal. And like, that's better than average. It's not just a little better than average. 14% better than league average. But I think the thing that makes this Mets offense a problem for opposing teams to deal with is that they're not as top heavy as they have been in the past. You think about Nimmo, Alonso, Marte, McNeil, Canna. It's balance. And they got a couple guys like JD Davis who've actually hit the ball really hard and haven't been rewarded yet. So there's a couple things that can still begin to go right for them as far as putting runs on the board that maybe haven't gone right. Lindor is the biggest one. If they get Lindor to play like the star that many of us think that he is, that's huge. And the timing really wouldn't be better if he started to get back into that level here in these next few weeks.
One thing I really like about the lineup, though, you know, I know that it has its flaws, but every lineup right now is, you know, other than maybe the Yankees, is struggling to score runs, is that it's very different. It's a varied lineup with varied approaches. You have Pete Alonso, you know, the big polar bear masher type, you know, and then you got Eduardo Escobar and Brandon Nimmo, who are pesky, take their walks. You know, then you have Starling Marte, total free-swinging doubles hitter, dynamic on the base pass. And they have Jeff McNeil, who's like the best singles hitter you could ask for. You know what I mean? Just a guy who can make contact with any ball anywhere. And then you have Canha, who's like a, you know, master of getting hit by pitches. So it's like, you know, it's no matter what the other team is throwing at them, one or two or three players in that lineup are going to have a strength against them, is how I see it. You know, you got high ball hitters, you got low ball hitters. I like the diversity on that lineup in terms of the different types of approaches. So I know that it's, you know, the another thing that masks their ability is Citi Field is much more of a pitcher's park, I think, than some people realize. It has been playing as a very pitcher friendly. And so, yeah, you know, it's a little bit difficult for hitters there.
Speaking of offenses that are underperforming, though, the Blue Jays, this is a pretty big surprise. I know it's mid-May, but about 40 games in is when you can start to look at teams and diagnose actual problems a little more effectively. I feel like what we do for the better part of the first month of the season is we say, it's just too early, it's too early. Here are some numbers, but it's still really too early to read into them. What are you thinking right now if you are running the Blue Jays? Do you look at this and say, this is the worst 40-game stretch this offense could possibly play to this point? I mean, right now, they're just under the league average in terms of WRC plus as a team. 97 is the number. That's a 234, 300, 378 line. This is a team that has that varied approach. They have a lot of different types of hitters. This is a team that should be among the league leaders in runs scored per game and WRC plus, and they're not there. They're not with the Yankees and the Angels and the Dodgers and the Astros right now. But I guess my question for both of you is, do you think they get there without shaking anything up, without making any sorts of major additions? I mean, what do you think, Eno?
It is weird. They are 24th in the big leagues in runs scored. That is weird. That is weird for me. But, you know, there's some process stats that still look okay for them. They're top 10, maybe 11th or 12th, actually, in barrel rate. So that means they're hitting the ball hard and in the right angles. They're just not getting rewarded for it. They're, you know, when it comes to hard hit rate, just how hard they're hitting the ball, they're actually second in the big league. So, you know, can they lift some more of those hard hit balls? Where I see a problem is in the plate discipline. They are free swingers this year. Maybe they're pressing as a team. They're seventh in swing rate. And when it comes to chasing balls outside the zone, they're in the top 10. So between those two things, you know, there is something under the hood that doesn't look great. They're being a little too aggressive. And some of that is just personnel. Bo Bichette is an aggressive guy. He's going to swing a lot, and he swings at pitches outside the zone. It's just who he is. But, you know, Vlad Guerrero is not that guy. You know, he's very disciplined, and Springer is normally very disciplined. I'm never like calling for, you know, firings or shakeups, and I'm not that kind of person. But I will say this, the one way that hitting coaches have the most effect on a team is when it comes to swing rates and chase rates. That's what the research says. So if they feel like their hitters are swinging too much and chasing too much, that is actually one place where a hitting coach change can make a difference.
Interesting. Yeah, I agree with all those points. You know, I think what's surprising too, when you look at the offensive numbers, is their inability to hit with runners in scoring position. I think they're right around last in the majors. They were at least earlier this week when I checked. And so that kind of shows the frustration as well. Like, guys are aggressive. They're getting into these situations so rarely, and it tells you that they're pressing, right? They're not able to come through. You've seen the outward frustration. You've seen guys break bats. You've seen them go up the tunnel, and you know what happens there. It's nothing good. they're unloading. So even when Toronto was off to like a hot start and winning series, they were doing it in spite of their offense. So I think that's why you're more concerned than you would be if this was just a 3 to 4 week like lull, right? Like, no, they haven't really shown signs even early on, and here we are approaching the quarter mark, which is around Memorial Day usually, and they haven't really shown those signs at all. It's not like the Mets with Lindor were like, okay, he showed signs, then he went into a slump. We haven't seen Toronto at all, so I don't know what the answer is. I know they've shuffled the lineup a little bit. I don't know if you make personnel changes. I don't know if you make player
what personnel changes are there to be made.
You mentioned the hitting coach.
I thought you were talking about players. Yeah, the players are locked in.
Player, I don't think you make changes. This team was kind of set up. They made a lot of moves in the offseason. A lot of people had them as one of the winners of the winter. I don't think you make player changes. I think you shuffle the lineup around and hope that as it gets warmer and the balls become a little less undead, that you can convert here a little bit. But again, everyone's playing with the same baseball, and the Blue Jays are still at the bottom, so you can't really just blame the baseball here.
Yeah, the most surprising underperformer of the bunch for me is Bo Bichette. I mean, I know he does swing a lot, but we're talking about a guy that is a top 15 offensive player in the big leagues, probably, when everything's going right. He's been below average to this point. Matt Chapman hasn't had the rebound that I expected, and both Teoscar Hernandez and Lourdes Gurriel Jr. have been slow starters through the first 40 games or so as well. It's a pile of players that, other than Chapman, I think because of a longer downturn in performance, which still could turn around, three out of four of those guys should be pretty much what we expected them to be going into the season. So I can understand being a Jays fan and being nervous just because of how well the Yankees are playing, the division you're in, the margins for error in the AL East, but the pitching looks really good, and the guys you're hoping for a bounce back from have really good underlying skills to believe in.
Yeah, I was all prepared to blame the ball for Bo Bichette's problems because he is an opposite field hitter, right? And opposite field balls, if you take 3 to 4 or 5 feet off of them, they really suffer. A pulled fly ball goes further just in general than an opposite field fly ball. But I just pulled up Bo Bichette's splits, and on balls going the other way, so opposite field balls, he has a 706 slugging. So that's not it, Eno.
That's not the one. It's not the problem.
Nope, not the problem.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
The ball is still a recurring topic, as is both of you are speaking to players on a regular basis. And it does seem like the detailed complaints about the baseball right now are a little bit different than they have been in the past. It seems like more of the focus now is on the material variation from ball to ball, like the slickness, even in some cases, the shape. Like what is going on? Why is there seemingly no end in sight to these concerns about the ball? And what's the latest round of complaints and gripes that you guys are hearing?
Eno, you want to take that one first? I feel like you're our certified baseball expert.
I know. The ball is my least favorite beat. But I just spent some time in the A's and Twins clubhouse, and I'm going to write about it for tomorrow. But the thing that is so upsetting to them is not only sort of this year's ball-to-ball variation, which may be caused by the interaction between the humidor and the ball. If you imagine taking water out of a ball and then putting it back in, which the humidor is doing on average in most of the new places, then you can imagine just sort of like a shrinking ball reinflating, you know, like, of course it's going to be weird and maybe different from ball to ball. And maybe the seams are higher in some places than others. But the real complaint that I'm getting is, again, you know, like I heard there were some players in the A's clubhouse were like, okay, so the ball changed and y'all told us we have to hit the ball high because now the ball rewards that. So we all have to hit high fly balls. And there was a whole change and we did all that. And it was great. And now the ball changes and now you tell us we got to hit it low. Which one is it? We got to hit it high. We got to hit it low. What do we got to do? And, you know, I was talking to Max Kepler and he's like, you know, sometimes I feel like it's too much information. And this is, Max Kepler is a guy who's actually reduced his launch angle. And he said in response to the way the ball was flying. So he's actually in the process of making an adjustment to this ball. And the last bit that just infuriates me as an analyst is that the humidor may change effects over the course of the season. The ball may fly out further in August, and all the people that did change would be like, oh crap, gotta, you know, start titting the ball high again, you know. So I think it's just frustrating for them as a players to have so much variation in the thing they use. And yes, basketball changed vendors, and you know, they changed how the basketball is made. There was like a 1 year blip in 3-point percentage, and there's something there. Football's had Deflategate. There are some issues with the balls in other sports, and actually in soccer, Kepler reminded me of this. Soccer, almost every new tournament, there's like a new ball sponsor, and so then there are complaints about the ball in soccer a lot. But the one difference is those balls are all machine made, and baseballs are handmade, and that's just wild. In fact, Kepler was surprised to hear that because, you know, that's just going to add another layer of year-to-year variation, ball-to-ball variation. I love humans. I'm not a robot. But when it comes to making balls and making thousands of balls, maybe it's not that big a surprise that they're different from ball to ball.
Can we just stop for 1 second, though, and acknowledge that Eno said, I love humans. I'm not a robot, which is exactly what a robot would say if a robot were trying to convince you that he wasn't a robot.
True. I have two quick points because it's one of my least favorite topics as well as baseball because there's nothing you can do about it. Right. I think players complain about it because they have no say in it. Yeah. It's something that MLB controls, and because MLB has messed with it over the years, and there's just no trust in terms of the instrument, right? So I think that's part of it. I think an easy solution to that is to have a board of players, hitters, pitchers, a couple of them that represent that group, and have them more involved in the actual process. Not, hey, this is your baseball, that's it, we're done. Have them more involved in the process. Now,
be more transparent.
I don't know if that can happen. Right. But MLB also owns Rawlings, right? And so a part of this is just the erosion of trust. Players think it's some kind of, like, you know, conspiracy. And
like Alonzo was saying, they're trying to take money out of our pockets.
Yes. Now, that is a certain group of players. Let me tell you who's very happy with this. Fly ball pitchers.
Yeah, right.
Pitchers in general. Pitchers in general are not complaining. I was with spent a couple days with Houston when they were in D.C., and that's a fly ball staff who has had amazing results. Coincidence? I think not. Many balls have died on the warning tracks this year, and if you have a good defense, and Houston has an elite defense, they are head and shoulders. I think they're plus 12 over the closest American League team, according to Fangraphs. In that DEF defensive metric, they're head and shoulders above, so they can chase those balls down and really make an impact. So you wonder if this continues, do the fly ball pitchers really have more of an advantage? Do you see a lot of these guys with huge home run totals that are far below that right now?
Fly ball pitchers are strikeout pitchers, so, you know.
Yes.
I do think that we might be on our way to some better baseball in the future, but right now I don't think this is ideal. You know, the batting average is like .230, you know, across the league.
But hitters have to change. This is forcing people who complained about the three true outcomes, this is gonna force them to hit the ball in the gap.
Kepler, I mean, this is exactly what Kepler's doing, you know, and maybe that is if more hitters did that, then it, like, because Kepler was a guy who hit .211 but hit 30 homers. Because he launched the ball in the air, and he was doing that, and he literally, I said, hey, this new launch angle is good for your batting average. And he goes, yo, I don't think batting average is it, man.
Yeah. But here's he said,
I don't think batting average is the thing, man. He was laughing at batting average. How far have we come?
True.
Yeah, because people don't get paid for it.
Jake Odorizzi was saying, like, it's gotten so out of control where it was like, okay, every single team, 1 through 9, could hit 30 home runs. How?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This now
that was 2019 was bad.
This is what I think people don't realize. The ball isn't dead. It's back to where it was pre like 3-4 years ago. So there's still going to be guys with elite power. There's still guys hitting home runs. You look at Judge, you look at Stanton, you look at Byron Buxton, right? There's still guys hitting home runs, except now it's just the elite power hitters that are doing it.
It's not Freddie Galvez hitting 30 or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that is a good first step. But the second step is as important as this step, which is do something about the strikeouts. Because right now we have all the strikeouts and none of the homers. And that's not super compelling.
Right. If you're going to have all those strikeouts, you needed to have the increase in homers. So we need that next adjustment, as you're saying. And I mean, I think the hard thing to really imagine is that we could flash forward to mid-August when the weather is gross for most of the country. And it's 85, 90 degrees first pitch. It's really humid. And the ball's going to play differently. And the things that were working for the first 40 games will no longer be working. And maybe it swings back. Maybe it becomes 2019 again. Maybe the extreme could be
because the ball will be dry and the ball flies better. This is something that a science thing that is not, it doesn't make sense to me, but ball flies better through humid air. The water molecules are actually easier to push out of the way than air molecules. That seems weird to me. But in any case, I think they're lighter. Water molecules are lighter. And so it flies better through humid air. It flies better in hot air. And if the ball is drier relative to what it's been in the past because it's been in the humidor, yes, we could have an August that looks more like at least like, you know, 2020 or something.
Yeah. So you get this massive change in the run environment from April and May to the rest of the season. I don't know if that's necessarily what you want either. Like that's not a level of consistency throughout the season that is good. I realize you can't control the weather, but if you're messing with the balls in this new way and you're getting this unusual shape to offensive production, that might not be good either.
What if baseball was just like, okay, now we hit 230 with no homers in April, and in August, everyone hits 260 and everyone's hitting homers. That would be like a weird shape to the season. I there already is elements there, you know, in a regular season, but that I think that would be if it was like more extreme and like then Freddie Galvis gets on a 30 homer pace in August, like it'd be kind of strange.
I don't want that again. I don't want players like that hitting 30 home runs in a season. No. To be completely clear, because it waters it down. It devalues the achievement on a micro sort of level to have it happen like that. One weird thing about this season, though, is with offense being down so much, there aren't that many hitters that are having these breakout sorts of seasons. Like, naturally, offense is down. Run environment is bad for offense. You look at some of the players that have actually taken big steps forward this year, and Jazz Chisholm Jr. is among the young players to take the biggest step forward so far. He is plus 71 in WRC plus compared to last season. So that's what a full-on breakout looks like. And I think with Jazz, there were rumblings that there could be big steps forward in the underlying profile. What we're seeing is a lower K rate. That's a big adjustment for him as someone that had pretty high strikeout rates, even in the upper levels of the minor leagues. And he's hitting the ball in the air a lot more than he did last season. I mean, as it stands right now, Jazz is on pace for almost like MVP votes in terms of what he's doing on a per game basis. There's power, there's speed, and there's a much improved slash line. Britt, you're actually getting a chance to see Jazz in Miami right now. And on top of all of this, he's just an exciting player, like a clear, like good for the game sort of player, because he's more like a must see player than a lot of guys we've seen break into the league in the last few years.
Yeah, he is. And I've got a piece that's hopefully going to come out on him soon. And what's been impressive, though, is you watch a game like last night and, you know, he hits the home run to tie it. He hits the sac fly to tie it. He is hitting the ball a lot more, like you said, in the air. I asked him about that. He said he didn't really change anything physically. He spent a lot of time working on like the mental component of the game. He credited Barry Larkin. He said he was a huge help to him. I think Miguel Rojas has been a guy who's really kind of mentored him. Rojas told him last year, like, listen, I know you want to win MVPs. I know you want to win All-Stars, but you have to look at it as a game by game basis. You have to like not look at the finish line and look at it as game by game, play by play, at bat by at bat. And I think he's really taken that to heart. The next step for him is really going to be having better at bats early on in the game. A lot of people still think he kind of hones in more depending on the situation. And so I think if you're going to really kind of nitpick about what he needs to get better at, it's going to be drilling down on that first at bat or two in the game. But he's made strides all around. And Don Mattingly was saying yesterday, like, do we realize how small he is? He's maybe 170 pounds. Mm-hmm. To have that kind of power when we're talking about the dead ball and how hard it is to hit it out right now, really impressive. really impressive. And I think he's kind of put Miami on the map in some regard, right? People who don't know who the Marlins are still know who Jazz Chisholm is. And I think that he's just been a really, it's been good to see his personality kind of come forward and then also him play well. Because I think last year, you know, that personality is great, but when you're not doing well, it grates on people. People don't take it the right way. So what you're seeing now is like both things together, finally, which is just really good for the game and also really good for the Marlins, who like very quietly are a pretty good team. We know about their young pitching. We know that the Mets may have some issues. And the Marlins, I think, have won five of six against the Nationals. They haven't had a super hard schedule, but they're a team that could make some noise here as we get deeper into the season.
Yeah, it's been really fun to watch. And, you know, one thing that's really interesting to me about what he's done is kind of just watching his, you know, his approach through the minor leagues and then his first year and, you know, thinking about all the complaints that people had about his, you know, bat to ball, you know, his strikeout rate, his, you know, his approach at the plate. He had these years where he had like really big walk rates, but he also had the worst strikeout rates of his career, where I think he was trying to be a little bit different than who he is, right? Like he had coaches telling him, oh yeah, be more patient, be more patient. Dude is just an aggressive guy. Like if you look at his personality, he's like, he wants to hit. He wants to hit the ball. He wants to hit it far. And what you've seen from the first year in the big leagues, the second year, is he is more aggressive this year, but some of that coaching still matters because he's reaching less. He's chasing balls outside the zone less, but in the zone, he's being more aggressive. And that extra swinging is he's getting to balls before he strikes out. You know, some guys, if they don't have great bat to ball skills, if they just sit there and wait, then they're going to get a called strike three, or they're going to get a swinging strike three. And that wasn't a great idea. Why did I wait? I just built up the count against me, right? For him, I think it's almost like the Josh Hamilton situation where, like, if he can swing and get to that ball before strike three, that's going to be better for him because he's going to put the ball in play and do something good with it. So I think, you know, it's not one size fits all. In other words, like, not everybody in baseball should swing less. He's the one guy where I think swinging more makes sense. It makes the most out of his skills. And we're seeing basically a breakout in every way that you could want. As Derek said, you know, doing everything you could want out of him. He's doing it all at the same time. And for what it's worth, I looked at the, you know, game by game graphs. It's not like this. He did this early in the season. He's just coasting off of it. He's hitting more fly balls with every game. The strikeout rate's going down with every game. Like this is legit.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point-of-sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/TheAthletic.
Among the other players, by the way, who have shown similar improvements in WRC Plus this year versus last year, it's a lot of guys that we've been waiting on for a little while. Josh Naylor, who just recently landed on the IL, and Manuel Margot, who also landed on the IL. Willy Castro just got another opportunity in Detroit the last little while. He's up considerably in terms of overall offensive production. And then Tyler Stevenson, perhaps a silver lining in Cincinnati, seeing him take another step forward behind the plate. Because he was good last year as a hitter, kind of sharing that role with Tucker Barnhart. Perhaps the most surprising player of all. I took a look at the barrel rate jumps year over year. Pavin Smith has the biggest increase in barrel rate from 2021 to 2022. It's an Arizona team that has really struggled to score runs. We talked about them maybe being a little better than people expected. I think that's a fair description of what they've been to this point, but the major issue for them is scoring runs. I think the Marlins underrated point, though, is one that's worth drilling into a little bit, because if you looked at the Marlins versus the Phillies and you had to pick one for the rest of the season, who actually finishes with more wins this season, it's closer than I thought it was at the start of the season. Part of it is the Marlins offense being a little bit better. Part of it's that the Marlins pitching is as good as advertised. They are good at preventing runs. I hope, for the sake of just his own health, we get to see Jesus Luzardo back at some point this season. But seeing him go down with an arm injury is really concerning. It's a forearm strain for Luzardo, because he was among the players having a breakout on the pitching side through the first 7 weeks of this season.
Yeah, I think also when you look at the Phillies, you look at Bryce Harper shut down from throwing for a couple of weeks too, right? This was an MVP last year. So the gap is smaller between the Phillies and Marlins than most people realize, I think, anyway, as we sit here, because of the injury factor and, you know, the way that the Marlins have played so far. Now, they haven't really played the Mets. You know, they've had kind of a softer schedule. So I'm curious, if we do this podcast a month from now, if we're still saying the same thing about the Marlins. But there is really a lot to like about that team right now.
Yeah, the surprise for me, they have a plus 19 run differential. It's the best among teams currently below 500.
And, you know, I think that if you think about, like, what, like, on these teams, like, who could get better? Yeah, Rhys Hoskins could play better. Aaron Nola could pitch a little better. I don't know. But it is obvious when I look at the Marlins team who I think could play better. Jorge Soler and Avisaíl García, their big free agent signings, have not played well. There are some under the hood things that look okay for them. There is a total possibility of rebound from both of them. But they are way below where they have been in their career and what they've done in the past. And if they play back to the back of their baseball cards, that's like a bigger shift than what I see coming for the Phillies. You know what I mean? In terms of, like, you know, who's underperforming for the Phillies, who's underperforming the Marlins. It's more obvious. And then on top of that, let's say they do lose Luzardo for whatever amount of time. The Marlins are well equipped to replace starting pitcher injury. Max Meyer have these stuff numbers that look at the physical shape of pitches. I've seen the stuff numbers in the minor leagues for Max Meyer, and they are absolutely on par with anybody, on level with Grayson Rodriguez, who for most people is the number one pitching prospect in baseball. So Max Meyer, if he comes up to replace Jesus Luzardo, they may not even miss a single step. They may even improve at that position. That's how good Max Meyer is. And then Edward Cabrera is also decent, but he's coming back from injury, a little bit wild, not having as great a season in the minor leagues. But, you know, they do have some pitching depth. So it's on Jorge Soler and Avisaíl García a little bit. But if they do that, then, and Jesus Aguilar, if those three kind of get going again along with Jazz, then they could actually have one of their better lineups they've had in a long time.
So my method for looking for pitching breakouts, I was looking at WRC plus changes for hitters 2021 versus 2022 using that Fangraphs season stat grid page. I was looking at K minus BB percentage for pitchers to see who's improved the most with the kind of a good overall pitching metric. The biggest improver, Eric Lauer, up 14.2% in strikeout minus walk rate. So he's just under 30% for the season. Not a surprise. Shane McClanahan, one of the biggest risers. He was already good. He's even better, kind of moving into the elite of the elite area right now. Luzardo was third. Shohei Ohtani doesn't count as a breakout he's better this year as a pitcher. Kind of fun that that's happening. Keegan Aiken, who's come up on a few episodes of Rates and Barrels, among the biggest risers. We talked about Steven Matz on yesterday's episode as well. Tyler Anderson's in there. And then Zach Gallen, another Diamondback. It's happening. The Diamondbacks are proving us right on that very soft prediction of they're just a little bit better than you think they are, which is how we've described this podcast for the better part of its entire existence.
Yes. It's the Brent Strom effect in Arizona. I don't know what the effect is for us, but you know.
No idea. They were getting lucky at this point. But Zach Gallen being healthy, I think, is a big part of why he's actually performing really well.
He had that little forearm injury that he got from swinging the bat, which he won't get again, at least in that same way. I've always liked him because he's got a lot of pitches. And for what it's worth, if there's a sort of underlying theme for all these guys, and in fact, I think it's true for every single one of them, because not every model or not every approach will have predicted all these breakouts. One thing that is true about all these pitches, they have a lot of pitches. You know, Eric Lauer has like four or five pitches, and he just started, you know, he went to the cutter more this year and added like a mile per hour in his fastball. Shane McClanahan has four legit pitches. Lizardo is at least a three-pitch guy, but he throws two fastballs. You know, Aiken has four pitches. Matz has four pitches. Tyler Anderson has five. I think Gallen has four pitches. So I think, you know, that is one thing that is hard to model is the value just of having more pitches. And I think that it's always a good thing when you have a young pitcher that's throwing a bunch of pitches. I think of Mackenzie Gore. He has this curveball and this changeup that, you know, are okay. It's great that he throws them because maybe next year the curveball is better or the changeup is better. Then he takes another step forward. That's what happened with Shane McClanahan. He improved his secondary pitches. He improved the shape on his fastball. I talked to him about it. He said, instead of trying to throw it as hard as I can, now I'm trying to spin it as hard as I can. And he said that simple little cue made all of his pitches better.
That's a big Houston thing, though, too. They don't, that, you know, they care more about the spin than anything else. It's, I like this breakout list. I think this Ohtani guy is going to be pretty good.
Yeah. Might be all right.
It says on the rundown, not a breakout.
I did cover myself. I did put in a built-in, like, I'm not saying this is like new, completely new, but it's interesting to see on that side, especially. I wondered if Ohtani had sort of peaked as a pitcher last year. Never assume anything about Shohei Ohtani and peaking and not having another level, because I think he'll make you look really dumb. The interesting thing here with Lauer, too, by the way, is that I think the narrative around the trade that the Padres and Brewers made a couple years ago, the one that sent Trent Grisham and then Zach Davies to San Diego in exchange for Luis Urias and Eric Lauer, that was in the shortened 2020 season. The reaction was, oh my goodness, David Stearns got fleeced by AJ Preller. The Padres smashed this trade. Trent Grisham looks amazing. Eric Lauer is just a guy, and Urias doesn't even have much of a role because I think he was hurt that year and might have spent some time on the COVID IL, if I remember correctly. Urias comes back in 2021, has the hitting breakout that a lot of prospect analysts were hoping for, and it looked a little more even. And then Eric Lauer in the second half showed flashes of what he's doing right now. And now Lauer looks like another great starting pitcher to put up with that big three in Milwaukee. And Grisham, unfortunately for the Padres, really off to a slow start this year. It's a funny arc for that trade because now it looks like the Brewers crushed it.
This is what it's like to analyze baseball. Like, you're right, and then you're wrong, and then you're right again. Like, I think that Grisham, I think he has an excellent eye. I think he will be better again in the future. I don't know if he will be as good as we thought he could be, but I think he'll be better than he is now. So I think that this trade could have another, you know, have another
four.
Way, another chapter where we look back and say, oh, you know what? It was kind of fair, you know, like, I mean, the one thing that Milwaukee did get out of that was more years of control from Lauer than they were going to get out of that other player. So even if they thought the pitchers just lined up and were about the same, they had Lauer for longer. And that was going to be important for them. But yeah, it's so hard to analyze things because players are changing. They're getting better and worse. And you know, every time you look at one thing, you can convince yourself of something. And then, you know, a month later, you're like, oh, man, David Stearns fleeced AJ Preller.
That is baseball.
You can also make numbers say anything you want, depending on when you start looking, right? The sample size.
Right.
It is.
Yeah, because if you look at the deal just using this year's stats, you're like, wow.
Yeah, 2020 happened, and Trent Grisham was good really in that shortened season still has underlying skills that we like. So this is not me saying David Stearns wins, but it's interesting how much the way you would look at that trade has changed pretty much each year since it actually took place.
I want to highlight one last name on that list real quick, because we talked about it on Rates and Barrels this week, but Keegan Aiken is a brand new type of pitcher. There's now a 2 to 3 inning pitcher. And I don't know if it's brand new like this year, you know, but in terms of like the last 2, 3, 4 years, there's a new pitcher out there now. The 3 inning pitcher, the bulk pitcher that'll give you 60 to 70 innings. And the Rays are kind of trying to tease Drew Rasmussen out of that. And the Orioles themselves have Tyler Wells. They're trying to kind of tease him out of that, you know, from that 50 to 60 pitch into the 70 to 80 pitch. But we now have a whole spectrum of pitchers. And this is something I thought that the Rays really, when they broke baseball, they broke a model that said, you're either a 1 inning pitcher or you're a 7 inning pitcher. And that's it. There is no in between. And I think now in baseball, we have 2 inning guys, 3 inning guys, 4 inning guys. I don't know if it's great for fans because, you know, who's Tyler Wells and why is he piggybacking with Aiken tonight? I get it. You know, maybe you'd know who Tyler Wells was if he went seven shutout. But for the Orioles, it makes more sense because they're going to get more out of a Wells-Aiken combo than they would if they started either guy and pushed them seven. So it's if we do change rosters and make teams only have 12 pitchers or 11 pitchers, we can kind of get rid of some of this. But I choose to also celebrate it because Keegan Aiken is doing some cool things. He's just doing it 3 innings at a time.
Well, the other thing you have to think about, and yeah, maybe it's not great from a marketing perspective, but also if you just let a guy go out there and get smacked for 5 innings, no one's going to remember that guy either because he's getting sent down. Right. And
that's
he'll
what
be out
Keegan
of the league
Aiken
in a couple
used to
years.
Do, right?
I also think from a development perspective, if you give someone a chance, if the options were you're going 6 or you're going 1, if you're going 1, you're not developing enough pitches to ever
to
go six someday.
Very rare.
If you're going 3, you can start to work on that second pitch or that third pitch that you need, and suddenly you're actually developing a starter maybe at the big league level. You're problem solving at the big league level with a guy that's helping you more in a 3-inning role than he would have helped you in a 1-inning role. So I don't hate it. I think there's a lot more good than bad, even if it's aesthetically different. We talked about the tag team videos. If you have tandem players, what do you think about this, Britt, from a marketing perspective? If you knew that it was going to be Wells and Aiken together and they were marketed like the Legion of Doom and they had this entry video together and then there's B-roll of them high-fiving and making sandwiches in the clubhouse and smashing beers together.
You could play with this, yeah.
You could do these things, right? Does this work? Can we make this appeal?
I'm Aiken for Wells.
It works if the two guys have personality and they're always together in that regard. It doesn't work if it's like this rotating cast of characters, right? It doesn't work if it's like the Rays opener and there's like cast of carousel of guys. It works if I know it's going to be Wells and Aiken. Then it's the Bash Brothers, right? Then you're all in. Then you can do this marketing stuff. But if they keep rotating around who these guys are pitching with, then no, you can't market that. In my
There was the idea that you would have, because right now in San Diego, they have 7 starting pitchers and they're keeping them all on the roster. And last night, Blake Snell went 3 and Nick Martinez went 4. It works if you have 13 pitchers. It still could get you in some trouble late in the season because you're keeping these 7 starting pitchers. You might have to burn a really good starting pitcher in a day that you're going to lose the game anyway. But there was the idea that it would be Snell and Clevinger. And you had this idea of like Snellinger. And you call it Snellinger, and then Snell and Clevinger are like totally different people. Snell's like a gamer, you know, type kid type, and Clevinger's like this out there, you know, kind of hippie-ish type. Like you could market Snellinger.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, you could make like shirts where they're kind of like one person with like two heads and the different silhouettes. And
yeah, because it sounds like a monster. Right?
You could have them on a tandem bicycle, and Snell's not even pedaling, but he's like playing an old vintage Game Boy, and Like, there's all sorts of stuff you can
Clevenger's
do with this.
Clevenger's all sweaty.
Yeah, Clevenger's doing all the extra pedaling. I mean, look, you got to have some fun with this stuff. If you're going to change the way the game looks, like, let's celebrate it in some new and interesting sorts of ways. Well, now let's get into this week's Player Focus, brought to you by Sunday Leadoff on Peacock. The spotlight for this week goes on Nolan Arenado. I said it on this show just a few weeks ago. I thought Nolan Arenado was at the beginning of a long and graceful decline with what we saw in his first season with the Cardinals a year ago. He's talked a bit about this in recent weeks. He's made a lot of adjustments over the course of the offseason. The results really speak for themselves. And I think part of the reason the Cardinals look a little bit different this season in terms of how they're winning games is that Arenado is playing more like MVP Arenado at the plate again. They're 10th in Major League Baseball in runs scored per game, which is something I did not expect to say about this Cardinals team, especially if you told me, oh yeah, Tyler O'Neill, he's going to get off to a slow start. He's not going to do much through the first 6 weeks of the season. He's not going to be the guy that he was last year. And Dylan Carlson, that breakout you're expecting from him, no, that's not going to be there either.
It's been amazing. And I think, you know, one thing you can do is bet on guys leaving Colorado. Like, hitters leaving Colorado seem to be better. I know Trevor Story is not having a great year, but the whole Matt Holliday thing, it really worked for Nolan Arenado when he left. And one thing that he really changed when he left the cozy confines of Coors Field is that he started pulling the ball in the air with the best. You know, in terms of pulling the ball in the air, he's top 10 this year, up there with Anthony Rizzo and Josh Donaldson and Byron Buxton, who've hit a lot of homers with that approach. And it's something that he did as soon as he landed in St. Louis. So I don't know if he saw the ballpark dimensions, saw that he needed to make the most out of his power in that way, but pulled fly balls are where homers live. And we're seeing an amazing sort of, like, I would say he's shifted the conversation from, you know, what will he look like in this graceful decline to, wow, he's got a couple more peak years left. And I think he's put himself in the Hall of Fame conversation in a way that he wasn't necessarily before.
Yeah. What I like is, yeah, he's making contact at a really rapid clip. He talked, and he's talked before, as you mentioned, about all the adjustments that he made. What's crazy to you guys is the timing. He can opt out of his contract after this year. And I'm with you, Derek. I thought his best years were behind him. He was just going to ride this deal out. But more and more, it's looking like, you know, if the season ends today, it's him and Manny Machado for the NL MVP. I think Machado's been a little bit better numbers-wise. But this guy could opt out of his deal and get an even better one, which would have seemed preposterous a year ago, right? And so the way he's been playing, and he's talked a lot about, you know, Albert Pujols helping him and just like that group with the Cardinals. And we mentioned this, just bringing back the band again a little bit, seemed like a very focused group. They've really, I don't want to say overperformed, but I don't know if people expected this out of the Cardinals at all preseason wise. And Arenado, obviously a big, big part of that. But I just think the personnel that they've assembled, this is just like a really fun team to watch.
Part of what makes this offense as a whole so dangerous, they do not have much swing and miss overall. I mean, Paul DeJong got sent down. O'Neill is always going to have that as part of what he brings, but he makes so much hard contact when he connects. You're willing to make that trade-off. Arenado has struck out less than 15% of the time again this year. Tommy Edman under a 15% K rate. Paul Goldschmidt under 20%. Harrison Bader has held some of that gain. I mean, Juan Yepez, who they just called up. Yeah, this team is really difficult to deal with.
Yeah, first in the big leagues in strikeout rate. And if the ball's not going to go out, you know, in a homer way, then you really want to make a lot of contact. They're doing exactly what you want to do in today's run environment. So, and another thing that's interesting, if we fast forward a little bit to the postseason, the one stat that becomes more important in the postseason than it is in the regular season is team strikeout rate. It's a powerful predictor of success in the postseason. So
we've seen that with Houston,
yes,
right? Time and time again.
100%. They do well with their strikeout rate. They really became the Houston we know now when they cut guys like Chris Carter and cut all the big strikeout rates and improved their strikeout rate. Even the Cubs, when they won it all, they had one of the best year-over-year strikeout rate improvements. So this bodes well for them, not only now, but like all season long. And it's not necessarily something that I saw coming in terms of this being like the best contact team in baseball.
It's really interesting, too, just thinking back to the pull approach of Arenado. I mean, the spray chart was crystal clear last year. Everything was to the pull side. That's still been the case this year. He's even pulling the ball more in 2022 than he did in 2021. But if the ball remains deadened, if the ball is not flying the way that it has in recent years, not having to hit it as far by pulling it is actually one of the hacks to continue hitting home runs. So I wonder if that's going to be an in-season adjustment that hitters can make. I mean, we've talked about Max Kepler not trying to launch the ball quite as much, but I think if you have the ability to pull the ball more than you have in the past, you're previously trying to spray all over the place because you wanted a good batting average and good OBP, maybe this is the adjustment we see other hitters make.
An oppo fly ball is not a good thing to hit right now.
Right. It's always been tough in St. Louis, right? As a pitcher-friendly environment.
Right. But in 2019, you could hit some oppo fly balls and they'd go out. I mean, I think that's my defining image of 2019, is the opposite fly ball where you're like, can of corn? Home run.
Yeah.
The opposite image is now like, oh, nice, pulled fly ball, home. Oh, not a home run.
An impressive series of adjustments, though, this winter by Nolan Arenado to get back to this level. And I'm with Eno. I think there is more of a Hall of Fame resume in place. It's certainly encouraging to see the possibility of a few more very productive seasons before that decline phase would possibly kick in for him. This has been this week's Player Focus. Change up your weekend with MLB Sunday Leadoff only on Peacock. We have to go. If you'd like to sign up for a subscription to The Athletic, you can do that for $1 a month for the first 6 months at theathletic.com/baseballshow. You can find us on Twitter. Eno is at EnoSaris. Britt is at Britt_Giroli. I am at Derek Van Riper. The Athletic Baseball Show returns on Monday.
At the 3-0 show, you've always got the green light.